You are my beloved. You are my beloved. Twice in the Gospels, heaven opens and those wonderful words are spoken into the heart of Jesus. Once at his baptism, as we read just a few weeks ago, and now on the mountain where he is transfigured, where he is lit up by the light of God. Once at his baptism, where he's gone to John, heaven opens, God speaks, "You are my beloved child." Now on a mountain, he takes his best friends, his disciples, the core of his group, along with him. And though they're tired, they hike up this mountain early in the morning. And there on the mountain, it's as if his face changes like Moses. And they see that Moses and Elijah, who represent all of the teaching about God, the Torah, and the prophets, it's as if they see them all together in conversation. Now, we don't read these stories always in sequence, so we miss some of the context. Jesus has been healing and offering hope to people all along. He's been going from village to village, and his disciples have been following him. They've argued with him, they've feared for him, and they've followed him. And he's been talking about how he's going to go to Jerusalem, and there he's going to be crucified and resurrected. And now they catch a glimpse, I think, of that resurrection. What happens on that mountain? What happens? What happens on the mountain? We've been thinking about how to live together in the covenant community of God's love. Last week, we heard the most important principle of all about how to implement that love here, how love doesn't insist on its own way, how love hopes all things and endures all things. What happens on the mountain? What happens when we are indeed lit by the light of God? Let me tell you a story. There was once an old stone monastery. It was tucked away in the middle of a forest, and for many years people would go there and they would find inspiration. But over time, fewer and fewer people went to the monastery, and the monks began to get angry. Maybe they'd just been together long. Maybe they missed the visitors and their inspiration. They began to argue among themselves. There were hurt feelings, and actually there were some monks who didn't speak to each other. The abbot of the monastery, of course, was distressed. And so he sought out an old friend, a rabbi named Jeremiah, and told him all about how the monastery had declined. People no longer wanted to be there because they didn't like all the arguing. And Jeremiah said, "Let me pray about this. Let me think about it." And he did so. And after a few days, he came to the abbot and he said, "I have had a vision. Had a vision. And my vision is this. The Messiah has come, and he's one of your monks, but I don't know which one." The abbot was stunned. The Messiah, one of his monks? He knew it wasn't him, but he went back and he convened all of the monks together and he told them about Jeremiah's vision, that one of them was the Messiah. He asked them to examine their consciences, and they did, one by one. Each of them knew it wasn't him, and yet he wondered if it was someone else, and he began to think, I better treat Norman better. And they did. Some who had long-time quarrels healed their quarrels. The words, "I'm sorry," were heard in the halls again. They didn't want to be left out. Which one was the Messiah? From that day on, the mood in the monastery was completely different. Pierre and Nibu felt left behind their frosty anger and sought out each other in forgiveness, and the monks somehow began to serve each other. And people who did wander in, who visited, sensed this new spirit. One by one, travelers spread the word about the remarkable spirit of this place, a place where the monks had learned to love because they believed the Messiah was among them. What do you believe? Do you believe in that love about which we've been talking? Almost 16 years ago, I stood in the chancel of another church, old church like this one, and it was a place that I knew well, a place resonant with meaning and history for me. But that day, another man was in charge, a man who's like a father to me, and I looked down the aisle to the back of the church, as ministers always do, and there was Jacqueline in a white dress, and she was standing there with a kind of light around her. I guess if you were a scientist, you could say it was just the way the windows were arranged. And she floated down the aisle. And there we were, two people who had been hurt in relationships before but had chosen not our past, but our future together. And so we were married. And in the covenant of that love, we learned to know each other in new ways, and we were healed. One more story. A couple of years ago, about this time of the year, I was still healing from a wound that I thought I'd never recover from. I was only just beginning to believe this astonishing sense I'd gotten from God that God wasn't finished with me, because I was finished with God. I really was. And so I, in a halting sort of way, had begun to respond to that by reading profiles about churches looking for ministers. And I read the profile that this church had submitted, which was nicely written, but I'd never been to Albany, and I really wasn't looking for a part-time job. And so I set it aside, and Jacqueline came and said, I think you better look at that Albany place again. And so I did, and we began to talk, and a few months later, I stood for the first time in this pulpit. I remember it well. There were big candles here that were lit, and everybody was afraid that when I did this, I would set myself on fire and be transfigured or something. Transformed, that's for sure. And many of you elected me as the pastor of this church, and together we set out, certainly with histories, but more importantly with a future together, a future about God's love. And we were changed, and we are changed. What happens on the mountain? What happens? In those moments, those disciples saw Jesus in a new way, and I think a new covenant began. We often live in the past. We use it to draw lessons. We use it to guide us, and that's good. But sometimes the past can become like a chain around our ankles. The gospel wants us to see ahead. The most common thing that's said about Jesus in the gospels over and over again is, he's on the way. He's on the way. You know, you can't catch up with Jesus hardly. He's always moving to the next place. He's always moving towards the next future. And I think transfiguration is a glimpse of that future, of where we're going. That's what all these stories are. All of these stories are about people moving towards the future of God's love. I tell these stories because transfiguration is not just on a mountain far away. It's in your life and mine. It happens when we open ourselves to God's love. When we take a moment to look up from our wounds and let God's love embrace us. Sometimes you know right away. Sometimes it takes a long time. John Sumwalt talks about a friend who had a powerful experience of the holy. And when she talked to a Buddhist priest about it, he told her not to try to dissect it, but just let it sit. He said, hold it in your heart. It may be years before you even catch a glimmer of understanding. What happens on the mountain is that the disciples saw Jesus in a new way. They saw him as a child of God, embraced and loved. And we're invited to see each other the same way. Like them, I think we often misunderstand Jesus. Like them, we aren't always ready to follow immediately where he's going. But when we do, when we ourselves hope in that love, have faith in that love, practice that love, Christ comes, God blesses, and the kingdom is here, right here among us. Today, what happens on the mountain can happen here. Amen. Amen.